This is the IBJ podcast for the week of October 29th, 2018. I'm Lindsay Erdody. The underused Pan Am Plaza in downtown Indianapolis could be getting a new life under a plan that is backed by city government and tourism officials. The site is expected to be used for a $120 million expansion of the Indiana Convention Center and two Hilton-branded hotels with a total of 1,400 rooms. Earlier this month, the Capital Improvement Board recommended construction of the project and voted to work with Kite Realty Group Trust on developing it. But it's far from a done deal, and many details remain unknown. I sat down with IBJ reporters Haley Colombo and Anthony Shutley to talk about what we know so far and what the project could mean for the city. Haley recently broke the news about the project, and Anthony has covered tourism and the convention business in Indianapolis for years. So thank you for both being here.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
So Haley, why don't you start by telling us what we know about this project so far?
So this is a pretty big deal to redevelop Pan Am Plaza across the street from the existing Indiana Convention Center. This is a $120 million expansion of the Indiana Convention Center that is proposed to be publicly financed, attached to two privately funded hotel towers totaling 1,400 rooms. And those hotel towers would potentially be Hilton brands, Hilton luxury brands, and the project is being developed by Kite Realty Group Trust.
One thing I found a little funny about this news is that Chris Gall, who is Senior Vice President of Visit Indy, told IBJ in September that they didn't think the city needed any more convention space. And we've already seen four major expansions of the convention center since it opened in 1972, and it ranks 15th nationally in square footage as it is. So what changed in that short time period, you know, from September to where we are today? Why is the expansion needed now?
Well, I actually asked Chris Gall about this earlier today, actually, and essentially he said that he doesn't necessarily think that the convention needs more exhibitor space, but that he does think it needed more ballroom space. And then there also have been concerned for a while about hotel rooms, and Anthony probably knows much more about that subject.
Yeah, so a rub on the ballroom situation is, and Visit Indy has been hearing about this for at least a decade, if you look at the configuration of the convention center, there are no ballrooms on the south end of the convention center. So all of that is set up on the north end, and that became a concern for a couple of reasons. One, because of the configuration with Lucas Oil Stadium and the way that a number of conventions are now starting to utilize that space. And two, as big as our convention center is getting, one of the key elements of that size is being able to host two conventions at one time. But you really can't do that if you don't have a ballroom down on that south end. So they've been angling to get a ballroom down there. And I think in the last couple of years, this plan has emerged to have a ballroom as a part of a hotel development on Pan Am Plaza.
And Visit Indy folks told me when they were, you know, announcing this deal that there are more than 200 conventions that they cannot bid on right now that are essentially require too much space, that they're saying that this will give them the ability to go after some bigger fish.
So for someone who's not as familiar with this, what is the difference between ballroom space and regular convention space? And can you explain that a little bit?
It's all about pillars. So people want big rooms with no pillars and no dividers and no obstructions in them, so they can set up displays as they want to. And also for big meetings, you know, 1,000 people or more. And so that's why you need these big ballrooms with zero obstruction in them. And also on the square footage part of it, not only is it important to be able to bring in bigger, larger meetings and conventions, but also to be able to accommodate multiple conventions at one time. But this is an important part of it. Conventions, big conventions, will take 3 days to set up, 3 or 4 days to tear down. And essentially your convention center is dark during those times, unless you have a big enough convention center where you can be tearing down one, setting up another, or holding one, tearing down one. And so there's this lag time of setup and teardown. So if you look at the occupancy of our convention center, many of the convention rooms are only 40% occupancy. Part of the reason of that is because of tear down and setup. So they hope to eliminate a little bit of that.
And so do you think this could do that for them?
Most certainly. Las Vegas is adding square footage. Nashville has come online with more square footage and a revamp, as well as Denver, Atlanta. All of those are in our direct crosshairs of competition. So it most certainly could put us in play for a whole slew of new conventions and gatherings and events that would never consider us before.
And I think, Haley, you mentioned that there's now 200 that we might be able to bid on that we weren't be able to bid on before.
That is what the tourism officials are saying. So we'll see how many they can book. I mean, this is also not necessarily just about bidding on new conventions. This is about being able to retain the conventions that we have now. The Future Farmers of America, or FFA convention, they are looking for the site of where they're going to host their 2025 through 2031 convention. And they announced the other day that Indianapolis was in the running along with Atlanta, and that they said that this Pan Am Plaza redevelopment project was a very good mark in Indianapolis's pro column, because they've been concerned about outgrowing Indianapolis as their convention sort of keeps getting larger. So it's also about keeping some of these big names here as their needs increase.
And I think it's important to note that while it's easy to point to, and very right to point to, the big conventions like Gen Con, FFA, those things that we know well, but I can tell you, for every one of those, there are a dozen conventions and meetings that people have probably never heard of. We have the Fire Department Instructors Conference that comes here every year. We have a huge wastewater treatment plant conference that comes here every year. We have Do It Best, which is hardware. Visit Indy doesn't care. The city doesn't care. If you're high profile, low profile, or nobody knows you, as long as your money is green and it comes in big quantities. And with those organizations, they do. Ask the hoteliers, ask the bars, ask the restaurants about the firefighters organization or the hardware people or the wastewater people. They love to eat, they love to drink, and they stay in pretty nice hotels.
Well, one of the things it seems that the tourism officials have agreed on for a while now is that downtown Indianapolis needs more hotel space and convention hotel space. So let's talk about the hotels that are included in this project. They would be considered convention hotels, is that right?
Yes, these would be hotels that would be connected by climate-controlled walkways to the rest of the convention center. They'll be connected to this new ballroom, but then also the ballroom will be connected via climate-controlled walkways.
Tourists and convention goers love the gerbil tube. Indianapolis is second, possibly second only to Minneapolis in its connectivity. It's key because our weather fluctuates so much. It's no coincidence that Minneapolis has a great labyrinth of these things as well. And it's really critical to fill that convention center in the winter months. It's hard enough to fill the convention center in the winter months. And so to have these things is paramount. It doesn't hurt that we've got a mall attached to it, as well as about 15,000 hotel rooms and the convention center and Lucas Oil Stadium all through connected indoor walkways, which is fairly critical, and it's been a key selling point to the city for a long, long time. In terms of that Pan Am site, I wanted to add that, you know, that site's been talked about for years and years. And I remember when the JW Marriott was cited, the Pan Am site was a close second place, and the city's had its eye on it for a long time, and they've had a rub with the parking lot below. Obviously, if you're going to build a building of that height and girth, you're going to need to have a massive foundation underneath it. And so working out that deal was critical and took a long time. This whole hotel thing goes back to at least 2010 and probably before. For those of you who have forgotten, during the 2012 Super Bowl, a number of NFL owners kind of made a big stink about the number of hotel rooms we had downtown. Yes, we had enough hotel rooms throughout the metropolitan area, but Indianapolis's size, you know, for its size, Indianapolis's metropolitan area is fairly spread out. And so having another 1,000 or more hotel rooms downtown is a huge part of it.
So do you think we're at any risk here for oversaturation in the market with another 1,400 hotel rooms?
Once these hotels come online, it's going to take several years for the occupancy rate to come back up to above 70%. So I recently just reported on this sort of downtown hotel blitz of all these hotels that are going to come online. Tourism officials said that because of this project, there could be some hotels that maybe not totally cancel their plans, but delay their plans to see what happens.
So the formula on hotel occupancy is this: when it gets to be at or around 70%, developers will look hard at developing more rooms. And Indianapolis has been ebbing around that 70, 71, 72% for a while. And from a historical note, it's important to remember when the 1,005-room JW Marriott was built, we were right around that 70% marker, and the city officials in Visit Indy were singing the same song, it's going to take so long to absorb these rooms, and so on and so forth. But the fact is that JW Marriott was such a huge attraction, it brought its own meeting space, which is critical. It could be not only a convention hotel, but a convention headquarters hotel, which means that conventioners, meeting planners will have their HQ there where, you know, people badge up and do all that pre-convention stuff. And so this space, too, on the Pan Am Plaza is going to be similar to that. So I would kind of politely disagree with Visit Indy and their assertions. And I think that the city will probably absorb that space. I think these new hotels like the J-Dub will create its own demand. And I think that we're going to probably be in pretty good shape. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some of these smaller hotels kind of continue, because cities need a variety of different kinds of hotels.
When we see new hotels come online, like the JW or like these ones that are proposed in this project, does it have the potential to drive the price down at some of the older ones that are downtown?
I think it puts an extreme amount of pressure on those hotels to stay renovated, to stay upgraded. We have seen a massive renovation at about a half a dozen of the big hotels. The Marriott, not the JW, but the Marriott, and the Hyatt has done a huge renovation. And those are just two of several of the big hotels that have put. And when we talk about these renovations, you know, we're not talking about a few hundred thousand dollars. We're talking about, in some cases, in many cases, tens of millions of dollars in renovations.
And you mentioned that meeting space was critical in the JW. Is there going to be meeting space in these hotels?
Almost certainly. And the $120 million ballroom, that's actually going to be a two-story area. It's not just a ballroom. It's a whole other set of meeting spaces and rooms and kitchens and whatnot that will be instrumental to creating more conference space.
So tell me a little bit more about how this project's going to be financed, how those hotels are going to be paid for.
So Kite is being pretty tight-lipped about the actual private investment that it's going to make in the two hotels. But what we do know is that the city is saying that it's going to invest $120 million into the convention center expansion, which is the ballroom and that other meeting space, as well as a walkway over Capitol Avenue to connect to the existing convention center. And the way that that is going to be financed, obviously things are still slightly up in the air, but Chief of Staff Thomas Cook, Mayor Joe Hogsett's Chief of Staff, has explained to me that it's going to be two methods of TIF-related financing. So obviously they're going to have to, you know, take out bonds to pay for this project. And one way those bonds will be paid down will be capturing the increased property taxes increment that will be generated by the project, and that will go toward paying down the bonds in the future. The other way is that the city directs about $8 million annually of TIF revenue toward the CIB, in that they are essentially going to redirect that, or want to redirect that, toward paying for this project and paying down those bonds. That obviously creates operational challenges for the CIB, because also that money goes to pay toward Visit Indy and like marketing and selling all of this. So obviously at a time when Visit Indy is going to have to be ramping up, that creates some operational questions. Then that brings in the state legislature, and the city hasn't been, you know, totally specific on what exactly it thinks the state should contribute to this, but it clearly thinks the state should contribute something. We will definitely be seeing how that plays out in the legislative session. Lindsay, you'll be covering that, so you'll keep us all informed on what happens when they write the budget and how this is included or not.
So I think the financing issue is a really interesting one, because the city under Mayor Joe Hogsett seems to be pivoting 180 degrees from what has been done in the past. In the past, for instance, the city contributed $59.5 million to the construction of the JW Marriott, and how that's supposed to work is after a certain amount of profit is taken from the developer, then the city gets a cut, usually 25% of the profit overrun. So it does take a while to get paid back, but generally over time they do, plus they get the draw of more people and more events downtown, which generates a whole stew of taxes, which then pays for the operations of the CIB and so forth, Visit Indy. So it's interesting to me, and it shows, if this is true, the confidence that the developers have in this site.
So for people who might not be aware of what Pan Am Plaza is, can one of you guys explain the site? Where are we talking about?
So the site is east of Capitol between Georgia and I think it Georgia and the railroad tracks. It is directly across the street from the convention center. It has a ton of visibility to folks who are in that area, and it's going to be very convenient for folks who are attending conventions.
And right now, the space is pretty underutilized, right?
Yeah, as the grand old man in the room, I can tell you that site dates back, as some of the listeners probably know, to 1987 when Indianapolis hosted the Pan American Games, which at the time was just a step below the Olympic Games. I mean, it was an international sporting event. So the idea was we built this Olympic-style skating venue. We built corporate offices to house some of the functions. And then we had this huge space in the Pan Am Plaza that was utilized for years as not meeting or gathering space, but event space. And it's been used, I mean, over and over and over again, Final Fours, Super Bowls. It's been a really good site for those types of things. ESPN had their headquarters and had their set on there during the 2012 Super Bowl. But over time, you know, back in 1987, we had a lot of space downtown, and we had a lot of buildings we could tear down and, you know, rehab and put new developments on there. But as time has gone by and the city and the downtown has become more mature, we've had less and less open space, the GM plant notwithstanding there. So it's kind of become considered a little bit of a waste. And the problem was, as I mentioned earlier, that parking garage underneath it, which is privately owned, which they've had to deal with. And then the ice rink became dilapidated, and they just, it kind of became a problem. So yeah, underutilized is an understatement on that.
Well, we've talked about how all this public financing could go towards this project in particular, or it's gone towards past projects that have helped bring conventions to Indianapolis. So clearly local and state leaders see the importance in conventions. Can you guys talk about why convention business has been good for Indianapolis?
So here's the deal with conventions. It's really interesting. It's an interesting conundrum for cities. And you have to make a decision at some point, because a lot of time the convention center sits there empty. It takes up a ton of room. Let's be clear about that. So the really huge convention centers, think about it. Las Vegas, you know, they've got a whole desert to build in, so they got plenty of space. If you look at the way the McCormick Center is situated in Chicago, it's not right downtown Chicago. So Indianapolis has taken the strategy of putting a convention center in a kind of a tightly woven downtown, which is unique, which makes us unique and gives us a unique niche in the market. You know, FFA comes here and Gen Con comes here, and they carry economic impacts in the tens of millions, and in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars, that really fuel our hotel scene, our restaurant scene, and a lot of our downtown business. So Indianapolis has really pegged its downtown on convention business, sink or swim. I mean, I think you could really argue without the hospitality industry, which has something like 65,000 employees, big, small, and otherwise, I think the economy here takes a really serious hit.
And so we've talked a lot about the impact this could have, what it could mean for Indianapolis, and what we know so far. But there are a lot of unknowns in this project and things we're still waiting to find out. So what are some of those things?
There are a ton of unknowns in this project. The CIB voted to, you know, sort of recommend that they continue negotiations with Kite. So it's not like they even have like a signed project agreement or anything like that. Two big unknowns are, so there was three sort of responses, or I guess finalists, for creating these convention center hotels. And we don't know who the other two finalists were. So that's another question. And I've asked about that, and they are saying that they're not releasing that information until there is a signed project agreement. You know, we don't know that if this was the best deal for the taxpayer out of all three. We don't know the private investment from Kite. We don't know if they'll seek any additional incentives. We don't know if the state will go along with investing in this, and you know, if they don't, like, does this deal even work, and how can they figure it out? We don't know if the owner of the parking garage underneath Pan Am Plaza will be favorable in selling it. So yeah, I mean, this project is mostly unknowns at this point.
And so that also means we've got no timeline for when any of this could even happen, since it's so up in the air still.
The city is saying that they want to have a deal wrapped up within the next 12 months, and they want to have a groundbreaking in 2019. We shall see if that occurs.
Well, you can read more about this project and the tourism and convention industry on IBJ.com. Thanks again to Haley and Anthony for bringing us up to speed on what sounds like could be a very significant project for downtown Indianapolis. Before you go, let me tell you about a couple stories we have in IBJ this week. By now, you've probably heard about this so-called blue wave that could help Democrats take back control of the U.S. House this year. But what does that mean here in Indiana? According to experts I spoke with for a story this week, you shouldn't hold your breath for that wave to spill into the Indiana State House. Also in this week's paper, learn about one of the city's premier philanthropists, Frank Basile, who is the winner of the Michael A. Carroll Award this year. The award is given annually to someone who has demonstrated the former deputy mayor's qualities of determination, humility, and service. Reporter Sam Stahl tells us about how Basile has become known for his generosity with his professional experience and people skills, and how his money has helped several major projects come to fruition. You can find these stories and more in the IBJ delivered to your home or online at IBJ.com. Thanks again for listening to the podcast. I'm Lindsay Erdody. Mason King will be back with you again next week.